This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is BFM 89.9, 11th of May 2020, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm Kusu Chuang and I'm with Philip C this fine day. Two things of monumental global important proportions happened last night. Phil, by far the most important one.
I'm waiting to see what these monumental issues of global proportions are. I'm anticipating.
Tenterhooks, right? By far the most important one was that Edinson Cavani signed a one-year contract with Manchester United.
Oh, good Lord.
And the second, and by far a distant second, was the fact that Malaysia declared a nationwide MCO.
Yeah, okay. It's not global, but it is kind of sad news.
Yeah, so it's a bit weird, right? Because the whole country, the shops can all open, but you just can't go in there and spend some time. You can see each other, but no more than 15.
On day one, day two,
you cannot.
Yep.
So I don't know lah. It's the second Raya in a season in a year already.
And I guess timing 2 days just before Raya.
Yeah.
I think we'll just catch a lot of people off guard.
It seems a bit knee jerk, a little bit like the retail and restaurant, measures.
And the issue we have is that we have been leading up to it. There have been selective closures. You do states, then you now announce national, all within a very short space of time. The question I had was, why didn't someone just take a step back and look at it holistically and say, okay, guys, let's just have done it, do it, and announce it 2 days ago nationwide and just prepare and plan it. I don't dispute that we probably need to do this.
Yeah.
But the question in my mind is, why didn't we just, instead of giving drip feed directives, why not you have done it as a blank announcement?
That's the thing. So it does seem as if policy-wise, they don't really have to act together. And they've had a long time. You know, it's been over a year. Mm. So yesterday, a lot of memes, right? CMCO, MCO, all the abbreviations.
You saw the Oprah memes? You got a car, you got a car. You got MCO, you got MCO. That was pretty hilarious, but sad.
Spot on. So it's going to be a tough week for everybody. Okay, so what are you going to be on after this?
Well, we're going to talk about the CEO-CFO relationship.
Yeah.
Especially during the pandemic.
Okay, and I will talk about the corporate equivalent of a spouse shuffling off the mortal coil when the other spouse shuffles off the mortal coil. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Broken Finger Blues by Richard Swift. I wonder whether it's related to Taylor or not. Probably not, right?
I doubt Richard Swift is related to Taylor Swift.
Just because, right? Yeah. Anyway, so this item from the BBC. The BBC, right? About glasses and how they are half full of water. There's two kinds of people in this world, right? Either the people who see these glasses as half full or that's half empty. And if you see them as a half full, right? Is there a danger to that? I think that's a real question.
And that's an interesting point because apparently, according to research, 80% of global population have some degree of optimism bias.
So glass half full people. 80%?
80% of people. You may not believe it because when we have conversations about, how terrible this is,
or
the nation or the government and all that, but still 80% of the world's population have some element of optimism bias.
Who came up with that huge number?
I have no idea. It is incredible, but actually when they did a survey, even between countries, usually countries like the United States and Australia are quite optimistic, forward-looking people, whereas, you know, the Brits and the French are not so. But when they talk to people about what their progress are, where do they see themselves in the future, there's always some drive for internal progression or moving forward. So no matter how you project it, I think there's an internal embed optimism for us to move forward. So we, I think, believe in ourselves more than perhaps others do.
Okay, so there's two kinds of optimism, right? Or states of mind, internal and external, right? Yeah. How you perceive yourself and how you perceive the external environment. Mm. So this is the idea in parallel also that social hierarchies exist and they've existed since the beginning of time, right? Mm. So whether it's an individual or whether it's a country, you do know where you stand on the ladder. Do you belong on the top table or do you belong with all the other unwashed masses, right? The lower you are in the social hierarchy, the more vulnerable you are to anomalous circumstances, right? So if something comes in and basically changes your, like you lose your job, for example, if you're quite low on the social hierarchy, it affects you much, much more than if you were someone who's a CEO.
It does.
Do you know what I mean? It does.
Right? But doesn't it want you to move up the ladder?
Correct.
Don't you want to move up the ladder? That's optimism.
Correct. So that's the impetus, right?
Yeah.
So this is what I was going to say.
I think it's so important. And when you talk about optimism bias, it's baked in everywhere. And even in the business world, we actually implicitly do it. So the example given in this article was the UK Olympics. Because they knew people had optimism bias baked in, they knew that they had to inflate the budget by 20%. You in the UK Olympics, to make sure that we met the budget, because people felt that they could deliver a project in this time when in reality they couldn't.
Yeah.
And I've had this personal experience where my bosses give me super stretch targets so that even though if I don't meet it, I still exceed last year's target, that's still progress for me.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying, right? So when you say this 80% survey, to me, it's where you amass the survey and in which country, because obviously the UK sits on the top table, right? Top five OECD, one of the richest countries in the world. So they would be able to handle exogenous circumstances very easily, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, say, the People's Republic of Congo. Do you know what I mean, right?
Oh, I see.
Yeah, right? So that's what I mean. So if you are able to get a seat at the top table and you are able to come near, the top 5 to 10% of your hierarchy, then you're able to deal with the circumstances, and therefore you would be more optimistic, and therefore you'd be able to fend off your adversaries much more easily.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I guess we have to understand that every country... I guess you're defining the table by material wealth.
No, not necessarily.
That, yes. Okay, let's say in Congo, maybe their definition of being at the top of the table are other things, perhaps wisdom or acquired experiences. So as a young boy, I would like to be able to have done this or had a family, had grandchildren, or actually been able to, hunt independently. Those could have been things they aspire to. So that's also an element of optimism, perhaps maybe we don't see it as.
Correct. So at an individual level, it could mean your physical size, your intelligence, maybe the material wealth of your family or yourself. At a country level, it could be maybe the level of democracy.
Absolutely.
Your governance framework, maybe your wealth, definitely, right?
Yeah.
The size of your geography. So China would be more powerful than, say, an Antigua. Do you know what I mean?
True. There was another dimension you said. You made a very interesting point about age. That actually the optimism bias hits a certain peak.
Oh,
right?
Interesting.
Yes, okay. At about 40. And I remember this, my old boss used to tell me that life is a reduction of options. But for a while I thought, wow, that's pretty profound. But for a while I thought that was really unhelpful as well. Because it kind of reduces your ability to think for the future. You know what I'm saying? But there is a point where you intersect that versus as you get older, that you think, maybe my optimism actually does reduce a bit as I grow older.
I don't think so, because the older you get, the more old people's rights you acquire. Do you know what I mean?
The
right?
Wisdom side, you mean.
Yeah, and the more impervious you believe you are from criticism, right? Mm. Rightly or wrongly. That's why sometimes you see Mahathir saying these ridiculous things, right? But he's allowed to because he's 96 this year. Do you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, the question here is when people are taking this don't care attitude, what does it mean, right? Does it drive you to grow and to learn? Or are you going to say, yeah, this is what it is, or take me as you take it, and I'm not going to develop further from that?
Well, I like the fact that you say 80% of people are more optimistic than not. So whether or not that applies to poor countries or rich countries, I believe that should all be always the base case,
universal.
Right? You should be more optimistic than pessimistic. Because what is the other side, right? This born loser mentality, not optimal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, human species is designed to progress forward. So, yeah.
Okay, 613, tell us what you think. The WhatsApp is 0187898899 or the Twitter handle is at BFM Radio, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the Fab Four, the Beatles, with a very apt title and song selection, with a little help from my friends in terms of what we just
nice
discussed.
Song, actually, to lead
it's a great
in.
Song. I think it's a Paul McCartney composition. But so moving swiftly along from that management type discussion we had on glasses half full or empty, in the same vein, I think, largely, Forbes has come out with this article about how in more circumstances than not, when the CEO leaves the company, the CFO also follows. It's a bit like life, right? When the husband or the wife of whatever, 30, 50 years marriage, shuffle off the mortal coil, typically within the next 1 or 2 years or even less, the other spouse also, joins the other half in heaven.
Because... In any corporate, I believe the relationship between the CEO and CFO is so critical. And this article from Forbes highlights how important that relationship has been, especially during the pandemic. when there's so many moving parts and you have so many decisions to make with respect to capital, resource allocation, and you need someone like a thought partner to think it through, the CEO and CFO is a pretty potent combination.
I would say it depends, because mm-hmm. the CFO would follow the CEO only if he or she was not as ambitious as you want him or her to be. If she or he is ambitious, she or he would stick around and ascend to the CEO position, say, look, I know the lay of the land. You might as well just make... It's an easy appointment, right? You don't have to go and look and go through the nomination committee and what have you, right?
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Yes. In the survey, actually, they say in CFOs, actually about only 18% of CFOs become CEOs.
Isn't
that interesting?
So assuming the survey size is credible it comes from a good source, right? Assuming all that, right? Why is that the case?
I think there's a bit of tension there. And for many people, the issue you have is that the CFO is, from the ground, either they've come from a corporate finance background or from a controller background, right? So there's this perception sometimes that the CFO is not strategic enough, because they always think the CEO and CFO are quite complementary. The CEO manages the executive visioning, the people side. The CFO decides how the money is spent. So when the board kind of picks who the CEO is, they think, okay, I need that kind of person. They cannot envision the CFO doing it because the pair is so complementary. They disseminate and do the kind of work breakdown that way. So you don't really give the chance for the CFO to kind of play the deputy CEO role.
Okay, I think that's only part of the problem, part of the reason. The other reason, I think, lies in the jungle. Because some of the time, if not most of the time, CEOs tend to leave the company under acrimonious circumstances. Right. And if the CFO is close to the CEO, you would want to get rid of that person because that person represents the luggage. Do you know what I mean, right?
I fully agree. Right? I think
so. It's emperor's new clothes.
Yeah,
right?
They're so close together. And especially if the CEO doesn't know his numbers, doesn't know how to do finance well, he's kind of attached to the CFO. Yeah. And the CFO knows that to influence, I just do this with the CEO together. They're kind of
one team lah.
Yeah, they're stuck in the hip.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge. Because the visions are all interconnected. The CEO wants to do this. Okay, CFO, play ball with me. Allocate capital accordingly.
So we've had a few examples of that in Malaysia, right?
Yes.
I don't know how deep we should go into that discussion.
No, I don't think we should go so deep into it. I do agree with you. In Malaysia especially, because if the CEO isn't very strong, the CFO is actually more potent and powerful. It's the quiet, invisible hand that drives a lot of the decisions behind.
Yeah, and also CEOs tend to have come from CFO backgrounds. When you look at the background and the profile of CEOs, they tend to almost always come from an accounting finance background because you know you're gonna make it happen, right? Cash flow wise, right?
Yeah.
They very rarely come from marketing or legal or admin or whatever, right? Very rarely one.
Increasingly though, I find that because the CEO depends on the changing market conditions that are coming through, right?
Yeah.
And also, you know, I do see actually more marketing commercial roles being taken over by the CEO.
Yeah, if for example, you're a B2C company like Amazon or Apple, right? Or for example, at Apple, you've got very, very senior people who've come from design backgrounds, like Jonathan Ive, for example.
Or they become CEOs of the smaller subsidiaries or businesses because they think, okay, the CEO of the smaller company, we just elevate the role to a larger role. They just have a larger mandate and portfolio. Yeah. That typically happens more as opposed to a CFO becoming a CEO. I think that's why the number is quite low.
Yeah. So because the last 1 or 2 years, and maybe even for the next 1.5 to 2 years, it's going to be a kind of like a lull, right, in the corporate world. Not many deals, not much development by way of like capital expansion or ambitious plans. For people who do want to ascend the ladder, right, I mean, what is the takeaway here? How do you adapt to this new normal? If for example, you are, say, FC now, financial controller, or deputy to FC, right? Or you're in line, if you're being groomed for the top role, how do we adapt if you're that kind of person?
I would just say make sure that you do your work that's multi-stakeholder.
Yeah.
That you are going to do work.
You're not too siloed.
Yeah. You're going to think from multiple stakeholders. You're going to think about the employee. You're going to think about the customer. You're going to think about not only your investors, because the CFO tends to be driven very much by the investor and how you, and the banks and the financial institutions you say. But if you engage and do projects that are multi-stakeholder driven, I think you show and prove your mettle that you can do many things. I think that's the kind of leader we want to
have. I've seen a lot of that actually in my last, you know, I've been working a long time, yes. Right? And typically the finance people, they tend to be backroom people. They don't tend to engage with customers. They don't speak well in public and they don't want to. They just want to remain in the background.
True.
It's dangerous, right? It's limiting.
But they become
it's a CLM.
But they become great CEOs if they use the basics they know about the business, the fundamental business structure and elements, and use that to engage customers. That's very powerful.
Okay. Well, I guess this is something to ask our listeners as well. How would you adapt if you're one of those people who are in line for a senior management role? How do you think people should adapt in the new normal? Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-889-8899. I made a meal of that. 018-789-8899. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Always with dreams tonight. I'm Chuang with Phil C. And we're discussing the international headlines at this point in time. And this item from the Financial Times about how Joe Biden, the US president, hot on the heels of his plan to tax the rich and give to the poor. He now wants to tax 100 of the world's biggest companies in countries where they do a majority of the business, but not in America. So this would include ExxonMobil, GE, potentially Apple, Alphabet, obviously Google. And this idea has come into opposition from critics because it says that the countries in which they do business, for example, developing countries, who are not part of the negotiating table might not make as much from this whole tax reform as they should, because that's where they make most of their money, right?
Yeah, so the question is, why is he doing this? I think he has a lot of bills.
He needs money, lah.
He needs money. He's got huge bills to pay. He's got that $6 trillion, three-type stimulus packages. A bit of context here. Yeah. Every year, about $160 billion is kind of lost in through this tax havens per se, and it's actually increased. It increased from 5 to 10% in 1990s, and now they contribute about 25 to 30% today.
Yeah, so that's a lot. And of course, US tech that used to put their headquarters in, say, Ireland, yeah, which was a very low tax, I think 15-16%, very similar to, say, Singapore, right?
Yeah.
Hong Kong as well, China definitely.
So there are a lot of competing proposals coming through. I think the challenge here is that the OECD is trying to corral all the developed countries together, but developing countries are not in the table. The UN is also coming with a proposal, but there's a lot of pressure to get a deal done by middle of this year.
Yeah, so it's a bit like if you allow, say Tesla to come to Malaysia,
yeah,
and they make a huge amount of money from selling cars in Malaysia, but the tax dollar doesn't come to Malaysia. It goes back to America. And that's the problem, right?
Yeah.
Okay, there's also this Colonial. Colonial is this huge oil pipeline on the east coast of America, which has been under attack from ransomware. Terrorists? I don't know how to call it.
Interestingly, if you see Biden's announcement, he said it came from Russia, but unlikely from the Russian government. From Russia, but he was also quite clear to not link it to the Russian government.
Well, he's meeting the Russians later today, he's going to bring it up with Vlad, right?
He's going to bring it up, but he has also been very careful to say it's not instigated by the Russian government. Just a bit about this pipeline. It is a massive pipeline. It connects the northeast of the United States from New Jersey all the way to Houston, Texas.
That's a lot. I mean, they supply half the entire seaboard, right?
Yeah.
2.5 billion barrels of oil per day, right? So that's a lot. And
the question here is, why is it that this pipeline was so susceptible to ransomware? And the reality is a lot of the sensors, valves, and pipes are all interconnected through IoT and digital connections.
Yeah.
And they attribute actually the fact that the work from home policy has resulted in engineers not going frequently enough to the pipelines to do the necessary checks.
So interestingly, right, the ransomware guys, they don't want to disrupt business. They just want money, right?
Whether
it's in Doge or Ether. And the thing is, we've also seen how Brent hasn't really responded. It's still about $68 a barrel a day. Yeah. So it's very interesting what this is going to do for prices if it continues.
Yes. It also has a question about this point about aging infrastructure in the United States. And I think this is going to be ammunition from Joe Biden's government to say, I need money and dollars to refresh our green tech and infrastructure, because as you can see, we're going to be susceptible to cybersecurity issues.
That's right. And as more people get vaccine, more people will hit the road and go for road trips, right? Which means more demand for oil and gas. Also in the Middle East, the Hamas-run Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said 20 people, including children, have died in airstrikes conducted by Israeli forces. So again, in Jerusalem, we've been discussing this the last few days. The conflict just seems to be escalating. Not good.
Yeah, this is centered around East Jerusalem, where there was going to be a decision made with respect to the settlements, Jewish settlements being planned there. It's also coinciding with a march being planned by pro-Israel parties, which has been postponed as well.
So, of course, America has to pipe in because they think they're the boss. They say, oh, you guys must de-escalate. Of course they must de-escalate, but who gives you the right to do so? Okay, so I just had to put that in. In Japan, 6 out of every 10 Japanese, I think, want the Tokyo Olympics to be cancelled. That's interesting because normally it's a gala marquee event for the country. It's big. I think the last time they had the Olympics, that was like, what, 70 years ago? 1950, yes. Right?
Quite some time ago. Yeah. And if you want to know more information, check out our podcast yesterday, Tokyo Olympic Staring Contest with William Pesek. It really is a staring down contest between the IOC Japan on whether they will cancel the Olympics, because if they don't get their show together and their support behind it, I think it could be a potential disaster for them.
As William was saying, right, history will be the best judge because obviously, you know, very congested city, very few people vaccinated. Is it a disaster in the making? We don't know, right?
Yeah.
Okay, 6:45, we'll come back after this with some local news and perhaps some social media. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was New Order with Regret, possibly an emotion that is being felt by many Malaysians all over the country because of the latest MCO that has been announced by the government, 3.0. We've had three already. Mm. So this particular edition of MCO runs from May the 12th, which is basically tomorrow, to June the 7th, a 25-day, I think, yeah, give or take, 25-day period, about 3 weeks. La.
Yeah.
What you can't do is basically dine in at restaurants. You can't have social gatherings. You can't have your nikah. No, you can actually. It's allowed in accordance with SOPs. You can go running, but you can't do like group team sports, I think. Maybe swimming is not allowed. I don't know. It's all a bit vague, lah. It's all a bit vague.
This and, begs the question, why is it we still haven't gotten into a level 1 to 5 system? Why is it that we always have to customize MCOs?
Yeah.
I still don't get it.
So which countries are doing level 1 to 5?
I mean, Australia had that.
Okay.
UK also had a certain amount of level system where you just say, okay, everyone, we go into level 1. Yeah. Okay, we've brought it down to level 2. It's just simple. Everybody can follow. There's consistency. People can plan.
Yeah, I mean, I've got this tweet that is being run on Free Malaysia Today, this guy called Jazli Aziz, who said that, so first they said no more at nationwide MCO, then they basically imposed MCO all over the country, but not exactly the whole country. Now there's a whole nationwide MCO. The indecisiveness of this government is astounding. Obviously social media are not happy. La.
Yeah, I think yesterday you could see and sense even from the WhatsApp groups that are churning around that there's a lot of dissatisfaction with this. Although I will say the only distinction between this MCO versus previous MCOs is that there is a vaccination program going on, right? And if you go to the Star newspaper on page 4, there was a bit of worry yesterday when 2,800 AstraZeneca vaccine appointments scheduled for May 15 and 16 were rescheduled to May 17 to 23 to kind of avoid congestion and overcrowding.
Okay, so 2,800 out of like, so that's 1% now, right?
Yeah, it's quite a small number and it's really confined to PWTC. But kudos, I do say, to the government for at least giving people the plan ahead and rescheduling them a bit to kind of spread out the flow.
Yeah, so yesterday we've had 3,800, just over 3,800 new cases. And Selangor is the top of the list again. So I guess it's also part of the reason because Selangor is one of the biggest states and we've had a lot of gatherings. It is, of course, Raya season.
Yes.
Selangor had 1,149 cases, Sarawak 650, and then Kelantan and KL. Kelantan has actually come up in the last few days.
Yeah, Kelantan did enter into the MCO about, I think, 2 weeks ago, if I'm not wrong. And so that, I think, also contributed. So I think that's why they kind of moved to this whole nationwide kind of action.
Okay, so 1MDB is back in the news. Page 3 of the Edge Financial Daily. Actually, no, well, Edge Morning Brief, right? So they filed multi-million dollar suits against everybody in the world, right? Deutsche Bank, Coutts, JP Morgan, Wong & Partners. There's a whole bunch of people named in the suit. So from people like Najib and Tan Sri Chet Lodin and all the way down to Nick Faisal, Arif Kamil, $7.8 billion is being sought. Then there's another suit aimed at Arul Kanda, the former CEO of 1MDB,
yep.
and Tan Sri Erwan Seriga, he of Red Shoes and Dancing fame.
And also former MOF.
$6.6 billion sought from both. An additional 3 million ringgit from Erwan Seriga. So, wow, a lot of money.
$22 billion, about 90 billion ringgit. That could cover more than our stimulus bills.
I just wonder whether these people have the money anymore.
I know. I was looking at the bills and I'm thinking, how realistic will they be able to recover? I mean, asking Arul Kanda and Tan Sri Irwan for $6.9 billion. Is that what I'm reading there? $6.6 billion from both, an additional RM 2.9 million from Tan Sri Irwan. I'm not sure whether they'll be able to recover the amount. Interesting.
$1.1 billion sought. In fact, about nearly 3 billion ringgit sought from Deutsche, Coutts, JP Morgan. Coutts, of course, the private bank, right? Very secretive Swiss bank. And JP Morgan. Deutsche is already reeling from the Archegos issue, right?
Correct. So, yeah. Although I think in the US, they've dropped all charges against Deutsche.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe Lo, famously, $1.03 billion.
Okay, so Joe Lo, his father, Tan Sri Lau Hock Peng, Eric Tan, Kim Lung, don't know who, one of his buddies, maybe Lau Mei Lin, one of the co-conspirators. In total, maybe about, $1.5 billion sought from them. Mm-hmm. No small change, but you know, if you're the subject of a Hollywood movie, maybe you do have a lot of money.
Yeah, just one thing also in the newspapers, as today quarter one GDP numbers are coming out, I think you're seeing it run in Starbiz and also my Malaysian Reserve, expectations that there'll be a slight dip in quarter one GDP, but countries' exports and output growth still remain strong. Not sure how that will be revised in view that yesterday MCO 3.0 was announced.
Okay. Also from the Edge Morning Brief, Gamuda has confirmed the plan to sell the 4 highway concessions to the government, a plan that was actually put in cold storage, but that was very public some time ago. And they didn't, however, acknowledge that the reported enterprise value of the sale would be 5.2 billion ringgit. Hmm. They were responding to a query from Bursa in relation to an article in this week's issue of the Edge Malaysia. So,
interesting.
Okay, 6:55, we'll come back after this with a 7 a.m. news and, of course, our markets discussion. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.